Your argument in Spencer versus Walmart.
May it please the court, Justices Hollenberger and Jacobs, David Serba, on behalf of the plaintiff appellant Valeria Spencer. Members of the court, a jury charge which absolves the landowner of all a liability, essentially as a matter of law, simply upon a finding that the invitee should have been aware of the condition created by the landowner or allowed to exist, is simply a charge that is repugnant to our system of tort jurisprudence and one which is based on comparative fault. The reason that I suggest that that is so is that the jury must be given the opportunity not only to assess whether the warning itself was sufficient, but whether it was sufficient under the circumstances to warn. In this particular case, the jury was specifically instructed that if the danger was apparent to the business invitee, in this case Valeria Spencer, then that condition itself constituted adequate warning.
Well, and I think everybody agrees with regard to this issue. Our standard of review is plain error, since there was no objection. And I think each side discussed the relevant cases, but where that puts us is you're contending something happened that was so wrong that we need to reverse the trial, and yet it was unnoticed at the time it occurred. So how do we get to a holding that what happened in this case constituted plain error?
Well, Your Honor, it was unnoticed, and for that I apologize. I had a duty to bring it to the court's attention. The defense had a duty to bring it to the court's attention. We all had a duty to get this right, but I take responsibility for not recognizing the deficiency in the charge. However, that doesn't make it any less deficient. What we have here is a clear charge that puts this squarely back to contributory negligence days. This charge is a throwback to contributory negligence days, and that's what warrants a reversal. Because of that charge, because the knowledge to the plaintiff alone became the sole consideration under this charge in the minds of the jury, assuming that they followed it.
But that's true.
That gets us.
That's true only with respect, I mean, if at all, only with respect to one of the claims of negligence. As I understand it, there were multiple claims. As to those, the jury was instructed consistently with comparative negligence. Is that right?
You know, there were multiple claims, all based upon, however, the same hazardous condition which was alleged by the plaintiff to have existed.
Well,
which
if,
were
if the if the danger, if the ready, I guess the obviousness of the danger is a defense to one of those claims, is it your position that it's a defense to all of them? That is, that establishing the that the danger was readily apparent would bar every claim?
The hazard complained of here was the piles of snow and the runoff created by them. The specific allegations of negligence were that the defendant did nothing to remove them, did nothing to periodically inspect them after January 5th of 2007. So I think the answer to your question is clearly yes. If, in fact, the obvious nature of the condition is the snow piles and the runoff, then this charge creates an absolute bar once the plaintiff becomes aware that that condition existed. And unfortunately, that wasn't a fact in contention at trial. Nobody disputed the existence of the snow piles and the runoff on the day of the accident in question or on the 4 days leading up to it. It all comes down to whether the landowner was negligent in either creating this condition through the actions of a third party, the snowplow contractor, or allowing it to exist. And by this condition, I specifically do reference, in the charges to the jury, the snowplows and the runoff, and that's the condition complained of.
Does the record show, I mean, were there special interrogatories to the jury?
There were special interrogatories, Your Honor, but the one dealing with liability asked only, I believe, whether or not the jury finds Walmart to be negligent, and that was the first of the special interrogatories, which the jury answered in the negative.
So we have no, there's no basis for us to conclude or suppose that the jury found, let alone or even focused on the issue of whether the defect in the land here was readily apparent.
Your Honor, the jury has the absolute right to be instructed on the correct statement of the law, and we have to assume that the jury applied the law as given to them. And this was the first of the jury instructions on landowner liability. Once the jury got to this instruction, if they had applied it and applied it specifically to plaintiff's allegations, they would have come to the conclusion that the condition created was one that the plaintiff should have been aware of and thereby absolve the landowner of all liability. I think the case of Probst versus State and one which follows Culver versus...
I'm not sure if that answer responds to my question. Was there a specific jury finding in response to a special interrogatory regarding whether or not the hazardous condition here was obvious?
No.
Okay.
There was not a specific question asked of them in that regard.
Okay. How do you reconcile your argument with, I believe, the undisputed fact that the trial judge did instruct the jury on comparative negligence?
Because this charge gets the jury around its obligation to perform an analysis based on comparative fault. Your Honor, the charge was given of comparative negligence, but the fact of the matter is that this charge, the one that's the subject of this appeal, once the jury determined that there was adequate warning given as a result of the hazardous nature of the condition itself, there was no corresponding obligation on the part of the jury to then weigh the plaintiff's failure to appreciate the risk created by the snow piles and the runoff against the landowner's obligation who created that condition or allowed it to exist for a period of over 4 days in a well-traveled area of its parking lot. So the jury never got to comparative fault. The jury found, the jury would have been allowed to find by this charge that plaintiff's knowledge represented a complete bar.
Was the jury, through special interrogatories, requested to make a finding one way or the other as to comparative fault?
Well, the jury,
whether the plaintiff was at fault in any respect.
The jury was asked if Walmart was found negligent, do you find the plaintiff also to be negligent? But that would have been, I believe, the second of the two special interrogatories. But the jury obviously never got to a consideration of comparative fault because there was no need to. Having found Walmart not negligent, and I would suggest that this jury instruction gave them the impetus to do that.
So then it's my understanding from your answer, the case was submitted in a fairly traditional way. Do you find Walmart negligent? If you find Walmart negligent, do you also find the plaintiff negligent? If you find them both negligent, what percentage do you assign to each?
That's
something to that effect.
Yes.
And what you're saying is that notwithstanding that progression, since they stopped with the first question, and they never answered or considered anything else.
That's correct. And this jury instruction allowed them to do that. And my position before this court is that this instruction is repugnant to the notion of comparative fault. What the jury should have been required to do, if they believed that the condition constituted adequate warning of a hazardous condition, they should have then weighed the plaintiff's failure to appreciate that risk against the landowner's decision to have created it in the first place or to have allowed it to exist for a significant period of time. But that weighing that analysis based on comparative fault would never need to take place by virtue of this jury instruction itself. This jury instruction says that on this hand, once the plaintiff is aware of it, you don't need to consider whether the landowner was reasonable in allowing it to exist or reasonable in failing to take steps to correct it. Once the plaintiff is aware of it, the case is over and done with as a matter of law. And I would submit to Your Honor that that's the same, the notion there is the same notion that the court found violative of comparative fault in the Koutaferis v. Dick decision, where the court specifically indicated that if the plaintiff were aware of the danger under the charge at issue, no liability would arise on the part of the landowner, even though on a comparative basis, plaintiff's error in judgment in not appreciating the risk might be far less blameworthy than defendant's conduct in creating the risk or failing to eliminate it in the first place. That's the analysis upon which the Superior Court in Koutaferis, or the Supreme Court in Koutaferis, sanctioned the trial judge's decision not to give essentially the same charge. That's the same reason why this charge is violative of comparative negligence principles.
So your position is that what the trial judge should have done was to excise from the instruction on landowner liability any reference to warning, either by the landowner or because of the inherent obviousness of the defect?
With all due respect, that's not my position. I agree that a landowner can warn and in the process perhaps discharge his responsibility with respect to an invitee, but the jury, since negligence is an issue that is particularly within the province of the jury to decide, the jury must be given the decision as to whether or not the warning is sufficient, but also whether it is sufficient to warn. If this jury charge is allowed to be applied in case after case after case, then what you have essentially is a situation where the landowner, the more notorious, the more obvious, the more nasty, perhaps for lack of a better term, the hazard that he allows to exist on his premises, the less negligent he becomes.
I'm just trying to clarify which portion of the instruction you find to be offensive.
I think that the latter sentence after the comma, where it says the condition itself constitutes adequate warning and the landowner has no further duty to warn or protect the invitee, is okay. The part that's objectionable.
Let's assume that that sentence were stricken from the instruction before the instruction was given. In those circumstances, the jury would still be told that there would be a duty to warn, correct?
There is either a duty to warn or protect.
All right. And if the jury finds that there was a warning, that is a verbal warning,
yes.
What then?
The jury must determine whether the warning was sufficient and whether it's sufficient to warn. Whether it is sufficient to warn. Is it sufficient, in other words, for a landowner simply to sit back and let that condition day after day after day constitute a warning?
I'm not talking about the situation where the warning consists of the obviousness of the condition itself. Take that out of the analysis. So now all you have in the instruction is that the jury has to determine whether there was a dangerous condition in the land. And secondly, it's told that they can find that the owner of the land was not at fault because the owner issued a verbal warning with no further discussion about obviousness. Is that how the instruction would read, or would it have to be amended?
I think this instruction would have to be amended to make it clear. Quite frankly, I think the instruction would have to be amended to make it clear that the landowner may discharge as a result of a warning, but that the jury must determine whether the warning is sufficient and whether under the circumstances of the facts of the case it's sufficient to warn.
So there would have to be, in order for us to find that there was plain error, we would have to also basically instruct the trial judges that in these circumstances there would have to be a massive rewriting of the standard instruction.
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I think that this charge is patently incorrect. I think that if it had been left out of the jury instructions completely, the subsequent charges that were given would have been enough. The subsequent charge specified that the landowner has a duty to inspect, correct, or warn.
Well, as I understand your argument, this court already decided that in Cuda Ferris, and the Superior Court should have given an instruction consistent with Cuda Ferris, and you admit you should have raised Cuda Ferris as a basis for having that instruction given, but the fact that you didn't raise it doesn't negate the fact that the instruction that was given is inconsistent with Cuda Ferris and, as a matter of law, prevented the jury from discharging its duty.
Yes. Yes. And that's what results in the prejudice here to the plaintiff.
Did you want to save your remaining time?
I just wanted to touch briefly, Your Honor, in a couple of minutes on the remaining issues.
Well, you can do that. You just will be using your rebuttal time.
I'll wait then until rebuttal. Thank you.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Justices. May it please the Court, my name is Karen Lee Turner. I'm appearing today on behalf of Walmart Stores East, LP. Your Honor, I'd like to pick up on some of the issues relating to the failure to warn. I think one of the things that we need to bear in mind in this case is that the jury instructions have to be read as a whole. The trial court, in instructing the jury, and this is found page B81 of the appendix that we have filed, the trial court, in instructing this jury, very carefully instructed the jury that the plaintiff had six theories of liability. One, that Walmart maintained its parking lot in a dangerous and defective condition by allowing piles of snow to stand where these piles could subsequently melt and refreeze. Two, maintained its parking lot in a dangerous and defective condition by allowing patches of snow to remain on its parking lot surface where it could melt and subsequently refreeze. Three, failed to take adequate steps to remove snow and ice from its parking lot surface. Four, failed to prevent the formation of ice through the proper application of ice melt agents. Five, failed to take reasonable steps to warn Valeria Spencer of the foreseeability of ice remnants on its parking lot surface. Six, failed to take reasonable steps to protect Valeria Spencer against unreasonably dangerous condition of ice on its parking lot by failing to regularly inspect for same. Now, the next instruction given by the court is absolutely crucial. And I read from the record. Now, Valeria Spencer has alleged defendant was negligent in various ways. But defendant Walmart did not have to be negligent in all of these ways to be liable. You may find Walmart liable if Walmart was negligent in any one of the ways charged. And I would also note for the record that the comparative negligence charge preceded the charge on failure to warn. I'd like to point out one fact that I think is obvious. This instruction only related to the failure to warn. The jury was properly instructed that there were five other grounds on which they could find Walmart liable. If they do not find Walmart liable on one of the other five grounds, there's no dangerous condition to warn about.
Well, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it seems that you may essentially be acknowledging for the purpose of argument that if Cuda Ferris versus Dick had been presented, at least with regard to the theory of warning liability, it might have been given differently. But having said that, the fact that no liability was imposed for the other five theories indicates that if that instruction was erroneous, it was harmless.
Your Honor, I don't want to concede the point on the first half of that, but I agree that it would be completely erroneous because, or completely harmless because no liability was found on the other five grounds.
All right. On the point that you, I don't want to use the word concede or anything else that you think has a negative connotation. And but I would be interested, hypothetically, if someone had said, Mr. Serba, to the Superior Court, you know, we've got this holding in Cuda Ferris versus Dick that appears to be inconsistent with where you're going, how would the court have said, well, Cuda Ferris versus Dick is distinguishable and I'm going to give this charge anyway?
Well, first of all, Cuda Ferris is not a failure to warn case. It's a failure to maintain a safe premises.
I know, but what we see in Culver versus Bennett and what we see in Cuda versus Ferris versus Dick is a theme that after Delaware adopted comparative negligence, juries need to be instructed in a manner consistent with comparative negligence, and the traditional tort instruction, probably needs to be modified.
Your Honor, certainly this jury was instructed with regard to comparative negligence. It would not necessarily be inconsistent with the doctrine of comparative negligence to also tell the jury, and bear in mind that we have to look at the entire instruction here, it's not really inconsistent with comparative negligence to tell the jury, if the danger, however, is so apparent that a business invitee can reasonably be expected to notice it and protect against it, the condition itself constitutes adequate warning, particularly in light of the fact that this jury had five other opportunities to determine whether or not there was a danger here and did not find a danger.
But what our court needs to sort out is how juries should be instructed correctly as a matter of law.
Going forward?
So hypothetically, mm-hmm. Let's assume there's only one theory, and the theory is the warning theory. What you seem to be suggesting is it's proper to tell the jury, if there's a huge pile of snow that is obviously melting and refreezing, in and of itself, that landlord or landowner has nothing to do because everybody knows big piles of melting snow are hazardous.
Your Honor, I'm stuck on one point, which is that conceptually I think it's impossible to ever have a case where warning is the only theory. Because warning presupposes a dangerous condition, and the dangerous condition itself is always going to be an independent basis for liability, or there'd be no injury to the plaintiff.
Okay, then you tell me the question you like, and tell me your answer.
Your Honor, I think ultimately, for purposes of this argument, Walmart's position is that even if the court believes that Cuda Ferris should modify the standard jury instruction, in this particular case, there is no harm because the jury was properly instructed that the plaintiff had six alternative theories and they could find liability on any one of those theories, and that therefore there is no plain error here that would require reversal. As to the more fundamental issue, I would argue that Cuda Ferris ought to be limited to cases other than failure to warn cases, because I think that there is an area, in the area of warnings, there is an area where something is so obvious that the plaintiff's decision to proceed ought to be considered by the jury, and that the jury could determine that there's no liability because of that.
So then your argument is not only was there not plain error, there was no error, and that if this reoccurred, this instruction is entirely proper.
Your Honor, I believe that's correct. And I think it's doubly proper because it followed the comparative negligence instruction so that the jury had comparative negligence, immediately followed it, and that the jury had been properly instructed that there were six alternative theories. But I think that if we could take just the duty to warn, I think there are circumstances where you are walking down the sidewalk, you see a large hole in the sidewalk, You clearly have the ability to go around that hole. You step into the hole and are injured. I think it's reasonable for the jury to be instructed, as this jury was, that if the danger, however, is so apparent that a business invitee can reasonably be expected to notice it and protect against it, the condition itself constitutes adequate warning.
But what I'm hearing, counsel, again, we're in this hypothetical area now, is that at least as far as failure to warn claims are concerned, there is no reasonable way to reconcile Cuda Ferris with the law on failure to warn as it presently exists. And therefore, the more reasonable approach would be to cut back on Cuda Ferris so that it doesn't reach those claims. Is that your position?
Yes. I believe that Cuda Ferris should not be applied to failure to warn claims. I think that this is a unique situation, bearing in mind that failure to warn will almost never occur in the absence of a defect which in and of itself could create liability. And Cuda Ferris is going to establish liability in those areas because the obviousness is not going to be a defense for anything other than the failure to warn. And I do believe that there are certain things that are so obvious that to proceed in light of those items.
Your argument, I gather, is that if Cuda Ferris is found to apply to the failure to warn context, you essentially abolish the defense that the defect is so obvious that any reasonable person could or should have known about it.
That's correct.
And that is not a reasonable direction for the law to proceed.
I would not perceive that to be reasonable because there are some defects that are so apparent or dangers that are so apparent that it should, in fact, the jury should, in fact, be so instructed. Now, if I could just briefly address the other issues that are presented before the court. We have an issue that has been raised on appeal regarding the application of the collateral source doctrine. This is another issue that implicates the pattern jury instructions. The jury instruction that was given is a jury instruction that accurately states the law. It explains to the jury that the plaintiff has, in fact, received workers' compensation benefits, but that they should not consider that fact and use it to reduce the plaintiff's recovery, that the plaintiff, if she does recover, will have a legal obligation to reimburse the workers' comp carrier, but if she does not recover, she will have no obligation to reimburse the workers' compensation carrier. This case is somewhat unusual because normally it's the defendants who are objecting to the admissibility of the workers' compensation lien and the workers' compensation information. And if you look at most of the cases where this comes up, it's usually the defendant who's made an objection. This pattern jury instruction was adopted because it, in fact, mirrors the provisions of the Delaware Code, 19 Delaware Code 2363, which relates to workers' compensation liens, and, in fact, was mirrored upon the committee's review of the DeFilly versus Delaware Electric case, which is cited in the materials that have been filed with the court. This jury instruction is fair because it provides both sides of the issue. Yes, they're receiving this compensation, but you should not take it into consideration to reduce the damages, and this is what will happen vis-a-vis your judgment, your decision as a jury, and the workers' compensation. Frankly, if we did not have this type of instruction, we don't know what would happen in the jury room because the jury presumably are relatively intelligent people who understand that perhaps the plaintiff is collecting workers' compensation. And if they are not instructed, they really do not know how to proceed to take that into consideration. And frankly, it's fair to the plaintiff that they be instructed as to exactly what's going to happen, and they should not reduce a verdict. And that is why frequently it's the defendant who's bringing this issue up. I would point out that it is, in fact, an accurate statement of law. The last issue that was presented for appeal is the issue relating to the admissibility of expert testimony. The trial court conducted an evidentiary hearing on the qualifications of the expert and whether or not this opinion should be admissible into evidence. The trial court very carefully followed the five-part test that Delaware has adopted under Rule 702. Whether the witness is qualified as an expert by knowledge, skill, experience, training, or education. Is the evidence relevant and reliable? Is the expert's opinion based upon information reasonably relied upon by experts in the field? Will the expert's testimony assist the trier of fact to understand the evidence or determine a fact and issue? And whether the expert testimony will create unfair prejudice or confuse and mislead the jury? The expert in this question is a forensic architect. He had no training during his architectural program on snow removal. The only training that he had ever had on snow removal was that he attended a two-day course at the University of Wisconsin in 1996, and he had helped his father in a snow removing business by putting down salt, not operating the plow. And he had worked at one point in time with a company that did building maintenance, and he was responsible for making sure someone came out and plowed the parking lots. He does not have that level of particular expertise, knowledge, and skill that we look to for an expert witness. Also, the court, having reviewed his opinion, noted that, much like the situation in the Goodrich case, which is cited in the materials, this opinion merely consisted of culling favorable snippets from publications and stitching those snippets together as a report. And she further found that fundamentally he was going to be usurping the role of the court because his opinion really consisted of nothing more than a charge to the jury. And it's the court's function to charge the jury. This was a full and fair evidentiary hearing, and the court's decision on this regard should be affirmed as the trial court was properly exercising the gatekeeper function that is the prerogative of the trial court. If there are no further questions.
Thank you very much.
Members of the court, Kuta Ferris is the correct statement of the law because it's the only statement of the law that encourages the jury, that forces the jury to weigh comparative fault, to weigh the failure of the plaintiff to have perceived the risk against the landowner's failure to have taken steps to correct the risk or to have allowed it to exist. And quite frankly, it does not matter how many allegations the plaintiff proffered at trial in terms of the different ways that Walmart failed to protect, because this particular charge nips every single one of them in the bud. It simply says that if the danger was apparent to Valeria Spencer, then Walmart has no duty to either warn or protect the invitee after that is established. So no matter how many specific allegations the plaintiff raised in terms of the different failures on the part of Walmart, every single one of them were extinguished upon a finding that the plaintiff failed to perceive the risk. With respect to issue number two, as raised on appeal, the plaintiff in this case went to a great extent of proving her special damages. We enlisted three expert witnesses, two of them who were involved in her care, to chart her course of treatment from the emergency room visit through the two surgical procedures, that were applied to her, through her postoperative conservative care, to explain the reasons for MRI studies, CAT scans that were done, to explain the methodology in terms of the different types of treatment and why physical therapy was advisable at various points in time, to explain why certain medications were offered, to explain why the diagnostic studies were done. And having gone to the great extent of proving the special damages, there remained absolutely no reason for the jury to be told that those special damages had already been paid by workers' compensation. It is a notion that was forced upon us at trial. I never intended to use the comp lien in any affirmative way. The defense, in fact, objected at the time of the pretrial to the use of the comp lien for the very reasons that it added nothing to the case, and it didn't add anything to the case. It was completely irrelevant and prejudicial.
Submit this was an abuse of discretion. So you're not contending it was an error of law. It seems under an abuse of discretion standard, sometimes you would let it be known to the jury, sometimes you would not. Why in this case was it an abuse of discretion?
It was an abuse of discretion because it only created the risk of prejudice in the minds of the jury by allowing them to be told, given the fact that the plaintiff had already proffered the necessary proof to establish those damages. It served nothing but to create the risk of prejudice in the minds of the jury. Why are we even here? This lady has already collected $125,000 in workers' compensation benefits. We need to go no further. As to the last issue, we have an architect who, by my calculations, was a practicing architect for 26 years by the time this case came to trial. He worked post-graduation in the maintenance industry, property maintenance industry, where he specifically dealt with issues of snow and ice removal. He received postgraduate specialized education over a two-day period of time at the university level in dealing with snow and ice abatement issues. If you go back far enough, you find that he even assisted his father in his father's own snow removal business. This is someone who was completely knowledgeable as to the standards. Thank you.
Thank you both. The court appreciates your arguments. We'll take this matter under advisement, and we will adjourn.